Major funding for the connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. President George Bush started a stopwatch for Saddam Hussein last night, giving the Iraqi president 48 hours to leave Iraq or face an attack. President Bush explained the rationale and timing of the attack by drawing a straight line between Saddam Hussein and the terrorists of Al-Qaeda.
The danger is clear. Using chemical, biological, or one-day nuclear weapons obtained with the help of Iraq, the terrorists could fulfill their stated ambitions and kill thousands or hundreds of thousands of innocent people in our country or any other.
The president is clearly sensitive to accusations that he's acting unilaterally or outside the umbrella of the UN. More than a dozen times in his speech, Bush referred to the U.S. and its allies as nations threatened by or willing to engage Iraq.
And a broad coalition is now gathering to enforce the just demands of the world. The United Nations Security Council has not lived up to its responsibilities, so we will rise to ours.
Connection listeners, this hour we're talking about the president's decision to use force in Iraq. How well has President Bush prepared the country? Has he persuaded you that it's time to start a new war in Iraq? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. And joining us this hour is Susan Page. She's the White House Bureau Chief for USA Today. And John Donnelly is also with us. He's Chief Diplomatic Correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's also in Washington. Susan, maybe I can start with you. I'm looking at a poll in USA Today that talked to people who watched the president's speech last night, and some 66%, two-thirds of people, are approving the president's decision. Do we note that as a change?
Well, it's a reasonable level of support, and I'm glad to hear that you've got a USA Today there. I think it's not an overwhelming verdict in favor of action. You know, sometimes we take these polls on the verge of military action, and 8 out of 10 or 9 out of 10 Americans are supportive. Our polling over the past several days, last night's poll and also a poll we took over the weekend, shows some continued unease, and it's clear that a lot of Americans would feel much better about this war if it was undertaken with stronger backing from the United Nations.
And John, I'm looking at other numbers that say as many as 7 out of 10 would support the president in the plan that he outlined last night. But you're writing today that there are a number of risks that the president is running with the tactic that he chose to take with his speech last night.
I think you're right, Dick. That I think that just by looking at who he had to address in the speech, speaking directly to the Iraqi military, saying that don't use weapons of mass destruction, don't blow up the oil wells, telling the Iraqi people that that help will be on the way, that we will liberate you, and also to the American people, saying that yes, the war will bring sacrifice, but this is, if we don't do it, he called it suicide, which I thought was an interesting way of framing the discussion this moment.
Did either of you feel that the president was taking the threat as he's explained it so far and exaggerating it to an extent?
Well, there's been criticism of President Bush and other people in his administration for exaggerating, in particular, one essential question, which is, are there links between Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein? And that's something that the U.S. has asserted. It was part of the presentation that Secretary of State Colin Powell made to the United Nations Security Council last month. But there's been a fair amount of reporting, and John, I suspect, has done some of it, that raises questions about how solid those links are. Of course, if that were the case, if Saddam Hussein had helped the terrorists who attacked New York and Washington on September 11th, the levels of support, I think, in the United States and around the world would be higher than they are.
I think Susan's right that the Al-Qaeda link is probably the weakest part of the administration's case. But I think they also suffered here because they didn't have any real direct evidence that that showed that Iraq now possesses weapons of mass destruction and intends to use it. They relied a lot on a long, long list of intelligence, And much of that intelligence was batted down by Hans Blix and Mohammed Al-Baradei, the two top UN weapons inspectors. So it's been very problematic build-up for the administration.
And if we set aside for just a minute how it is we got here, we should probably take a look at how the president signaled in his speech why and what he's intending to do, because it in many ways is a significant shift in the U.S. military doctrine. Let's listen for a half a sec to the president.
The cause of peace requires all free nations to recognize new and undeniable realities. In the 20th century, some chose to appease murderous dictators whose threats were allowed to grow into genocide and global war. In this century, when evil men plot chemical, biological, and nuclear terror, a policy of appeasement could bring destruction of a kind never before seen on this earth. Terrorists and terror states do not reveal these threats with fair notice in formal declarations. And responding to such enemies only after they have struck first is not self-defense, it is suicide. The security of the world requires disarming Saddam Hussein now.
John Donnelly, it was your reference to suicide that the president is talking about in that particular part of the speech. But how do you measure that shift in doctrine?
Well, I think it was signaled back last fall when they published the new national security doctrine. But having it theoretical and then now, in the moment, sort of on the eve of war, when it goes into force, when they actually execute on this plan, is as you said in the opening of the show, Dick, it's a roll of the dice, it's a gamble. There's a lot really depends upon two things, I think. One is how this war goes, whether it's short and casualties are kept to a small number. Then the Bush administration will be seen as possibly taking the right path. If the war is protracted, if they're fighting in the streets of Baghdad, then there'll be a swell of opposition to the administration's course. And the second thing is whether when the U.S. forces go in, whether they will then find this cache of weapons of mass destruction. If they find underground bunkers full of chemical and biological weapons or mobile laboratories full of weapons, then I think that there'll be some vindication for the administration.
You know, it's remarkable. I don't think there's ever been – I tried to look at this question for a story I did that appeared in yesterday's paper. I don't think there's ever been a military action we've undertaken where we've been so sure that we will win and so uncertain about what will happen in the aftermath. And one reason the debate in the Security Council has been so fierce, and why France in particular has been so willing to open this breach with the United States, is that they also see this as being about much more than Iraq. This is the first test of a policy that the administration sees the United States that acts without the kind of checks that international institutions like the United Nations have put on U.S. action in the past half century, since the end of World War II. This is one of the most significant shifts in the way the world's arranged that we've seen in our history. It's like the period after World War I, after World War II. It's something that we expect to lay the foundation for a different way that the U.S. will approach the world for decades to come.
Now, both of you, we're going to talk a little bit further about that and with our callers as the program goes on. But I want to just check in with Charlie Sennett, who's joining us now on the line from Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. Hello, Charlie.
Hi, how are you?
I'm fine. The part of the country where you are is the part of the country which is held in large part by the Kurds rather than by Saddam Hussein. Am I right?
That's right. This is the semi-autonomous zone that the Kurds carved out here after 1991, and which is basically protected by the U.S. and British enforced supply zone. And so it's kind of a unique, what they would call free Iraq, right up here in the northern corner, straddling Syria, Turkey, and Iran.
Now, as free as these people have been for the last 12 years living under the protection of the no-fly zone, they live with the constant knowledge that Saddam Hussein is just to the south of them and a constant threat. Were people there tuning in to the president's speech last night or listening to the message from Washington that within a short period of time they might not have that threat to worry about anymore?
They are very tuned into what's happening in Washington and largely watching it on the Al Jazeera network, which is kind of the Arab world CNN. And it was interesting yesterday in Cham Chamal, which is the border town right up against the part of Iraq still under Saddam Hussein's control. In that town, you can see all of the Iraqi military positions up on the hill. You can see different posts and different armaments that are dug in and all of them pointing down at Cham Chamal. And yesterday, as news spread that Bush was going to issue this ultimatum, you know, these are people who know war very well. And it's almost like a seasonal understanding of war. And they began to just do what they naturally do, which is get up into the hills, get up out of the lowlands, and get away from the fighting as quickly as they can before it comes. So what we saw on the streets yesterday were tractors packed with families and trucks full of livestock and bedding and food and people just fleeing by the tens of thousands up into these kind of snow-capped mountains in the distance where they can get out of harm's way. And for them, the biggest fear is a chemical attack because the Kurds, of course, know Saddam's history with that. They suffered it greatly. And we just a few days ago had the 15th anniversary of the Halabja chemical attack where 5,000 Kurds were killed in 1988. So all of these memories of what Saddam is capable of through his chemical weapons program resonate very strongly here. But I should add, they're also very cynical in their understanding of it. They wonder why America uses the Kurds as the poster children for this war, but America hasn't offered any gas masks here. There are no Patriot missiles to defend them. There are no early warning systems set up. And feel very abandoned and have, of course, a history of being double-crossed by everyone in the region, in Iran, Turkey, and the United States.
Charlie, I wonder if I can just...
Especially.
If I can just interrupt you for...
They're very cynical, but hopeful as well.
Charlie, I'm interested just briefly in knowing whether or not, as some of the civilians are heading for the hills, are there Kurdish soldiers, the Peshmerga, are they getting ready to fight a northern front?
The Kurdish soldiers want desperately to fight a northern front. I'm not sure the United States is going to let them. The United States is very worried about the Kurdish Peshmerga going into cities like Kirkuk, which, of course, is the huge prize in one of the northern cities in Iraq, which sits above a real motherlode of oil reserves. And, in the city is a kind of tinderbox of ethnic divisions and religious divisions that could really explode. So the U.S. wants to keep the Peshmerga out of Kirkuk till it can seal it. Whether or not it can is really a big open question.
Charlie, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Charlie Sennett is the Boston Globe's London Bureau Chief. He is in Sulaymaniyah in northern Iraq. Connection listeners, we're reflecting on the words of the president last night and the 48-hour countdown that he has given to Saddam Hussein and his two sons to leave the country or face an attack. We're interested in knowing from you whether or not the president has made the case in the manner that he would have liked to have done it. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
From Boston University, this is WBUR.
You're listening to The Connection from NPR. I'm Dick Gordon. Charlie Sennett, in his dispatch from Sulaymaniyah there, just talking about the suspicion and the sense of betrayal that some of the Kurds are feeling as they prepare for the final hours leading up to what's expected now to be a U.S.-led attack on Iraq. And as John Donnelly said a little earlier in the program, John's with us, he's also the Boston Globe chief diplomatic correspondent, that the president had a number of audiences that he was making, that he was addressing in his speech last night. One was specifically, and he made the point, through a translated radio broadcast to the people of Iraq.
In a free Iraq, there will be no more wars of aggression against your neighbors. No more poison factories. No more executions of dissidents. No more torture chambers and rape rooms. The tyrant will soon be gone. The day of your liberation is near.
Now, Susan Page, White House Bureau Chief for USA Today, that message to the Iraqi people is in many ways one of the most difficult that the president will have to deliver on.
Boy, is it critical, though. You know, the White House, the administration is very hopeful that the first pictures after U.S. ground forces move in will not be of Iraqis fighting back, but of Iraqis welcoming them. And that would be such a powerful statement in favor of the position that President Bush has taken. And they're also very hopeful that even if Saddam Hussein is willing to use chemical and biological weapons against U.S. forces, that his commanders will not. And that's one reason you've seen a consistent message over a period of months, public message directed at Iraqi military personnel saying, do not use these weapons. You'll be prosecuted for war crimes. Put down your arms. We're going to win this war. Don't give up your life for a despot who's on his way out. But it's impossible, I think, to accurately judge the sense of the Iraqi people at this time. I think it's one of the great unknowables as this war begins.
Our telephone number is 1-800-423-8255. We're going to try and get a line through to Baghdad at some point this program just to see what we can find out there. Communication is very difficult with the Iraqi capital right now, but they are not difficult with Worcester, Massachusetts. And Peter's on the line. Hi, Peter.
Good morning.
Thanks for calling.
You're welcome. Just a comment. Last night I watched and I listened to President Bush, and subsequently I said, oh, sorry man he is. And then this morning, irony upon ironies, I listened to Tony Blair from Parliament, and I said, oh, we're doing the right thing. I wonder if we could import him.
That's probably not the first time that suggestion's been made, and I'm sure it's been made inside the White House. I mean, Blair has been a very, very staunch companion of the president on this, John Donnelly. Very important connection there.
I think he has been the most articulate of the leaders who favor going to war. And I think he's also instrumental, we saw last week, in the very hasty announcement of a reopening the Middle East peace process and looking at trying to give some sense of balance. He was very explicit about it. That for people in the Middle East, that this isn't that our only concern here isn't just about weapons of mass destruction and oil in Iraq. It's also about the Israeli and Palestinian people, and especially the Palestinian people. That what has been happening over the last 29 months, I guess, should come to an end. And this is the opportunity to do that.
All right. We do actually have our connection through to Baghdad, so why don't we take advantage of talking to Scott Peterson, who's correspondent with the Christian Science Monitor now. Hello, Scott. Can you hear me all right?
Sure I can. How are you?
I'm fine. That's a great line. I'm interested in knowing how people in Baghdad are responding to the president's ultimatum delivered last night.
Well, at the moment, it's been very, very quiet here today. In fact, it's been the quietest day I think that we've had for weeks. People really do feel now that war is imminent. Shops have been pretty much shuttered today. People have been keeping inside. Yesterday and in the days before, we had some very, very serious efforts of people to kind of stock up on food, on water. People were buying generators, definitely preparing, taping their windows. But now it seems that they really do feel that it's imminent, and so they're preparing, and it's really been the quietest day here for weeks.
Any sign at all that residents of Baghdad are leaving the city? Are you able to go to the road to the west, for example, and watch that?
Well, there's no question that people are leaving the city. I was speaking to a family yesterday, in fact, that was very, very distraught about not being able to leave. Like many Iraqis, they're very, very poor. A mother of eight children just didn't have enough money to leave the city. And so that seems to be a limit for some of them. But many, many people have left in the last couple of weeks. They've sent their families out. If they themselves were going to stay here and otherwise just trying to get to areas outside of Baghdad. Some have residences in other provinces, and so that's a safer bet. And people just aren't sure what to expect, and so they're doing everything they can to kind of maximize their chance of survival.
And any opportunity at all, Scott, to gauge the Baghdad residents' response to the message in the president's speech when he says, you know, the day of your liberation is near. This is not an attack on you. We're simply after your leaders.
Well, I think that, you know, a lot of Iraqis, I mean, it's very difficult to tap into exactly what Iraqis think about that. And to be honest, in recent days, they've been much more concerned about how they're going to basically get through the coming days and weeks, more than they are worried about what may or may not happen to the regime as a result of that. So it isn't really really too clear. I'm not sure, while some may think that being liberated from Saddam Hussein is something that they would be looking forward to, I think on the other hand, this has been such a long, drawn-out process that a lot of people here, they certainly tell us this, are concerned that it's actually the Americans who might change their government for them. And in fact, many, many Iraqis speak about how they would view American troops here really as new invaders.
Quick last question for you, Scott. Any sign that the system that the government puts in place to control information, the minders who work with you, the appointed drivers, is that still holding up?
Well, at the moment it is, but it's changing almost every day. Most of the journalists have moved to one single hotel. There were three that were on offer, but two, which are far, far too close to what we expect to be the likely target area. So most people are in a single hotel at the moment. In terms of minders, it really just seems to change day to day. Some television crews have had minders that have been sent to other duties in the ministry or sent to be at hotels, in fact. So they're not really moving around. There really hasn't been much work in the way of TV or other things in the last day or two. People just haven't been able to move around. And in terms of those who are staying, we've just been completely tied up with logistics.
All right, Scott, thanks for your time. Watch out for yourself.
Take care. Thank you.
Scott Peterson, correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor in Baghdad. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Connection listeners, this hour, a chance to test response to the speech of the president last night. We'd like to hear from you. To Raleigh, North Carolina, David's joining us now. Hi, David.
Hello.
Tell me what you heard and what you thought.
Well, I heard a lot of platitudes and essentially statements that President Bush had made before. I do not think that he's made his case. That has been my trouble with the issue from the beginning, that I do not think he's made his case. He did say one thing that I thought was a complete falsehood in his allusion to making a direct connection with Al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein. And I just simply do not think the case of war is justified. And the major thing that troubles me about the whole issue is simply that he's taking a gigantic gamble, a huge roll of the dice with both American lives and also with lives of people in the Middle East. And if he pulls it off, he's a big hero as far as a lot of people are concerned. And if he doesn't, then look at the consequences. I just don't think that war is really ever justified except in the most extreme circumstances, and we simply are not at enough of a threat to justify this.
David, thanks for your call. Let me go to Susan Page, if I can. She's White House Bureau Chief for USA Today. The sentiment that David's expressing, are you hearing that at all in Washington from Democrats?
David is exactly right. I mean, we've had months where we've been talking about the prospect of a war with Iraq and how would it go and what would the aftermath be. We're at the point now where we're going to see the reality of what happens. And I think the reality of what happens will determine everything. Are we greeted as liberators, as we hope, or as invaders? Do we find stores of weapons of mass destruction or laboratories clearly designed to develop weapons of mass destruction? These are the reality of what happens in the coming days and weeks is going to determine whether this is a success or a failure and whether President Bush stands as someone who saw a threat before others did and acted, or someone who had a policy that was misdirected. In Washington, we spend a lot of time talking to each other, but this is a moment where the reality of what happens is going to be driving everything.
1-800-423-8255 to Virginia Beach, Virginia now, and Craig's on the line. Hi, Craig.
Hello. Thank you for the forum. I just want to say I agree with what we're doing. I think anybody that doesn't think that he has biological and chemical weapons just isn't paying strong attention to the evidence. But my real point is I think we're witnessing a metamorphosis of the world, and we do have to become preventative in the sense that we can't let dictators It used to be that we would let dictators, people that we were concerned about because they only had conventional weapons, you know, we would let them do their thing and we weren't too concerned about it. But in this day and age where weapons of mass destruction are becoming easier to obtain, we have to become more preemptive and take the weapons out of these people's hands. And I'm concerned.
Craig, let me just interrupt you if I can. Was there a time that you can mark when you decided that, yes, this is the right thing to do, or have you been with the president all along?
It's not necessarily the president. I mean, and again, they said he hasn't made his case.
Yeah.
I think the case goes back 12 years. And so it's been an ongoing thing. So I think what he's doing is right. And like I said, what I'm concerned about is that more people, you know, the next person we're going to have to deal with is North Korea, because we can't let irrational people have weapons of mass destruction. I envision 20 years from now, and maybe I'm being a little wacky, but I envision 20 years from now, maybe there's a substance, you know, P532, and a vial of it can poison our water system. You know, we have to stop irrational people from getting irrational weapons, and I am extremely confident that when we do get in there, which we will, when we do get in there, we will find weapons of mass destruction. And I don't think he needs to make a link to Al-Qaeda. I think what the problem is he may have been linked to Al-Qaeda.
Craig, let me just step in there if I can, because what I'd like to do is have John Donnelly address a couple of the points that you've made. And in principle, among them, John, is the list that that Craig had, that, you know, after Iraq, then comes North Korea. Certainly that's one of the signal marks of this metamorphosis that Craig's describing, not necessarily of the world, but of the U.S. military policy as well.
I think you're right, Dick. But I think interesting at this moment that the reason, one of the reasons that many people feel like the United States is going after Iraq now, is that it's comparatively it's easier than it would be to go after North Korea. And also, one of the reasons that the president has made about going after Iraq now is that it doesn't become another North Korea, where a dictator will have weapons of mass destruction and then could use that as blackmail against the rest of the world. But a lot of people think that why aren't we addressing North Korea if North Korea is believed to have one or two nuclear weapons, if it's one step away from restarting a fuel reprocessing plant and then they can build or manufacture enough plutonium to build one weapon a month. It's a very murky area, and so it has fueled a lot of speculation about why Iraq and why now.
Susan, what do you think about the change that Craig's describing and John's talking about?
Well, it's certainly the fact that both these crises have developed at the same time in Iraq and in North Korea has certainly spotlighted that this administration has taken very different approaches to them, because the consequences of a military action against North Korea would be so catastrophic. It would involve perhaps the use of the nuclear bombs we believe they already have, and the, you know, incredible devastation in South Korea, including the capital of Seoul. So it's hard to envision how we would go to war with North Korea. It just seems too, the consequences seem too severe in contrast to the war with Iraq. Now, this President Bush, I think, bears some of the responsibility for the bind he's in on explaining his different approaches, because he combined the two nations in his State of the Union address more than a year ago, when he described North Korea and Iran and Iraq as an axis of evil and suggested that perhaps we should approach all of them in a similar way. I think the administration has done everything it can to delay having to address the situation in North Korea until Iraq is over with, because it seems so difficult.
Let me hear, though, from both of you on the way that the president has recast the authority that he exercises. He began last night by addressing questions that perhaps he doesn't have the legal basis to act. Let's listen to that.
the United States of America has the sovereign authority to use force in assuring its own national security.
But then a little later on, the president sort of answered his own question.
This is not a question of authority. It is a question of will.
Is it either or like that, John, Susan?
Well, you know, there's no question that a country has the right to defend itself. The problem is we haven't been attacked. And that's why the president's articulated this new policy of preemption. But it's not one that everybody accepts. It's one that seems, in fact, at odds with some elements of the U.N. Charter. And it's one that Kofi Annan, among others, says is not justified.
But, John, when the president turns to the question of will, does this country have the will to act? That is also the sort of classic turn just prior to war when people say, yes, we're with the commander-in-chief. In part, that's what's happening here, isn't it?
I think it is to some extent, but I think what we have to look at is how the U.S. does this turn, and whether it is acting, in a manner of arrogance and saying that it will go alone no matter what. I think that's why in some ways that with Tony Blair speaking about some of these things, it's the earliest caller mentioned this, and that a lot of people feel conflicted inside themselves and will change their minds from one day to the next about whether this is the right move to make.
All right, Connection listeners, it is part of the president's job, and he's been doing it over the past weeks and months to prepare the country for a war. In your view, how well is he doing that? How well has he done that? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR.
Funding for The Connection is provided by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. Available on the web at www.macromedia.com.
University, this is WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. We're funded by you, our listeners, and by Mercury Corp.
My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. Our number's 1-800-423-8255. And a review of the president's decision and announcement last night that Saddam Hussein and his sons have 48 hours to leave Iraq or face the likelihood, the inevitability of a U.S.-led attack on that country. President's job is to make the case. We're interested in hearing from you whether or not he is making the case, how well he's making the case. 1-800-423-TALK. Let's go to Belmont, Massachusetts. Dick's joining us. Hello, Dick.
Hi. Susan said earlier that Bush's decision to go to war will be judged on the basis of the reality of what actually happens. My question is, how will we know what that reality is? With half of the United States believing that Saddam Hussein organized 9/11, and with Colin Powell presenting falsified records to the UN, my concern is that we will be presented a false picture of what that reality is. My question to Susan is, how will we know what is real?
You know, I think that's a fair question, because on some of these issues, for instance, the development of weapons of mass destruction, it's not necessarily something that's transparent. You have to rely on the interpretation of experts. However, we are going to have one of the things that the Pentagon has done that I think is a good thing is allow reporters to be embedded with troops. So we are going to have independent journalists observing what happens as the troops go into Iraq and how they're received. And I guess I do think that sometimes not instantly, but over time, we end up getting a pretty accurate picture of the reality of things. So I guess the short answer would be, I think we need to count on, to some degree, we're counting on U.S. officials to be honest, but we're really depending on independent analysts, journalists, observers, and others to tell us what's really going on in Iraq after a war begins and after it is over.
But how do you explain how half of Americans believe that Saddam Hussein organized 9/11? I'm a businessman. If I promulgated that kind of dishonest statement, I'd go to jail.
Well, there is a difference of opinion on the links between al-Qaeda and the September 11th terrorist and Saddam Hussein. There are divisions within the Bush administration about how solid those links are. And so I think that it's not surprising that the public would also be divided on that question. But, you know, you talked about the judgment of history, and I think that we do are able over time to make smart, informed assessments of what the reality of things are.
1-800-423-8255. Dick, thanks for that. Let's go to Westboro, Massachusetts now, and Leo's joining us. Hi, Leo.
Hi, how are you?
Fine, thanks for calling.
I listened to President Bush's presentation last night, and I had always been somewhat on the fence, but deep down in my heart, I've known all along that we really have no choice but to go in and do this job because we know that nobody else is going to do it. The United Nations has basically proven that it is ineffective when it comes time to making the tough decision. And if we don't go in, we're basically going to be held hostage by this man and all of the other tyrants that occupy the Middle East. When you go back to 9/11, that day changed everything, and for some reason or other, I sense that a lot of people, not only in the United States but also the world, have forgotten about 9/11 and the fact that they took the war to us. And whether there's a direct link between Saddam and al-Qaeda and all that really is immaterial. The fact of the matter is these countries have the types of materials that could terrorize us for a very long time.
Does it mean, Leo? Does it mean that after a war in Iraq, then the United States is in effect obliged to go to the next bad guy down on the list and say, more of the same for you, buddy?
My opinion is if that country demonstrates a willingness to use the kinds of terrorist weapons that were used on 9/11 against us, absolutely. We are the only country that will be willing, maybe along with the British, to take it to them and demonstrate that this kind of behavior will not be tolerable. I have a French heritage. I work in the nuclear industry, and I'm appalled that France's attitude about all this, given the fact that if the Allies had not invaded Normandy in World War II, mm-hmm. Who knows what the French government would look like or the French countryside would look like today. I just want to add one more point. In regard to the use of oil, having been in the nuclear power industry for almost 30 years now, I think that this country is somewhat hypocritical in the fact that we use so much oil and the rest of the world looks at it, sees us wastefully using all this oil. I think these are times when people really need to examine their conscience and say to themselves, is nuclear power all that bad?
All right, Leo, let me just take it from there and ask John Donnelly to respond. John, the point that Leo's making, that the case, in effect, has been made.
Well, I think one of the issues here, I think you touched on it too, Dick, is what happens after Iraq and who chooses where to go next? What will be the proof? Will the public get to see the evidence of if the administration decides to next address Iran or Syria or even Saudi Arabia? The other scenario is, what if another country also adopts this policy of preemption, and what is the United States' reaction to that? I think it raises a lot of very murky questions.
Now, the president gave a speech, two or three weeks ago now, laying out an extremely rosy vision of what would happen in the future. And the administration view is that successful action in Iraq will convince rogue nations from having links with terrorists because of the threat that the U.S. would take action. And he says that the nurturing a stable democracy in Iraq will provide an example elsewhere in the region, encourage democracy in places like Saudi Arabia. Now, that's, we all of us hope that that's happens. There are some people who are kind of skeptical that it will happen, but the administration does have this view that there are consequences short of war that will be very helpful throughout this region, throughout the world, really, if the action in Iraq works as they hope.
But I think, Susan, what you raise actually is one thing we haven't talked about that much, and that is what happens in Iraq right after a war. There are so many uncertainties with that, and it's a country which has never had a democracy. To expect that the U.S. goes in and is able to sow the seeds of democracy and help install leaders is a real gamble. I mean, I've spent a lot of time in Iraq, and my gut feeling is that the biggest thing to watch out for is some internecine warfare, especially in the north, where U.S. troops won't be in large numbers. There's a good chance of a battle over oil, especially around Kirkuk. Without much security there, with the U.S. forces coming up almost entirely from Kuwait, that it could take some time to get things going. And if things get out of hand right away, it would be difficult for the administration to recover from it.
Let's see if we can get back to our lines to Greensboro, North Carolina now. Wiley's on the phone. Hi, Wiley.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
Sure. I just wanted to say, as a Marine and as a former Marine, I think too often we all seem to think that our armed forces and that our war parties at hand are interested in the aspects of war. And no one wants a war less than those that serve in the military. It's the last thing that we ever want to do.
Which is why we're talking about the political decision that the president's made, right?
And I understand that. But to have someone make a statement, and it absolutely jars me to my soul, to have someone make a statement that says, that the case hasn't been made and that we are not, that we're acting in a preemptive manner. It stopped being preemptive when we were attacked on our soil. And I appreciate the forum, and I do appreciate the freedoms by which we live and able to dispute and argue and reflect on what's happening around us. But at the end of the day, I think we all need to reach out and embrace our leader at this point and show some type of solidarity as to the fact that we are under attack. We're under an economic attack. I work in the financial world now. If you look at what's happening to the individuals, their retirement accounts, and the instability of what's going on in this war, it's devastating to those that are approaching retirement and devastating to those that have failed to be able to prepare any more properly than they have.
Wiley, I want to bring you back, if I can, to what you were saying about the commander-in-chief, because you've got a perspective here that I want you to share with us. You said at the end of the day, people have to stand with the commander-in-chief. Now, in your view, if I take what you're saying right, the end of that day was the evening of September 11th. But for a lot of people who've been scratching their heads about that and the events since then, are you saying that now we are at the end of the day, the end of a time when we should be saying good, bad, right, wrong?
I think good, bad, right, wrong, the decision's been made. And it's an unfortunate decision. It's not one that I do fear attacks on this soil now from us taking this stance. And I fear for my children, and I fear for my family, and I fear for those people that are abroad. But the choice has been made, and it was nice after September 11th to see the United States in a stance where we actually felt good about being one solid union. And that's been lost. It's been so long since then, I think people forget. And we lost our corporate headquarters in World Trade Center. And we lost a number of employees in World Trade Center.
Wiley, I'm going to interrupt you there because I don't have a lot of time left on the program, and I do want to get a reaction from both John Donnelly and Susan Page to the point that you're making. And both of you, your Washington correspondent, how are you seeing what Wiley's talking about played out in the nation's capital?
Well, I think he's quite right that that once the war begins, there will be a rallying around the president. Even in the poll we took last night, one out of five people we polled said they disagreed with Bush but would support him because he was the president. And I think that's a powerful instinct. We'll see that played out in Washington on Capitol Hill. There's been criticism from Democrats, sometimes fierce criticism about the approach Bush has taken. I think that will stop about now, when the war starts, and won't resume until U.S. troops are no longer fighting a battle there.
I think Susan's right, but I also 2 points. One is that I've talked to a lot of former Marines who are very patriotic, obviously, but they're also critical of how we got to this moment. And the second thing is, I was at a large anti-war rally in Washington over the weekend and talked to a lot of people at it. And I would say, you know, the decisions have really been made. Why are you here today? And they said that they felt like they needed to have their voices heard, that this is a democracy. And they felt like they couldn't live with themselves if they sat home. So. But I think we are. I agree with Susan that there'll be less and less criticism in the next 24 to 72 hours.
So just to pick up the thrust of what Wiley was saying, John. Yes, there is the new threat. Yes, these are new times, and there's been a lot of debate. In your judgment, does that mean that some of that debate is going to continue rather than there being this complete falling into line behind the president?
Well, there will be. I mean, there's still, even today in the Capitol, there'll be some more civil disobedience outside the White House last night during the speech. There were some loud protests going on. It's, you know, I think people in the United States also feel like they don't want there to be one voice heard from here. They don't want the rest of the world to think that everyone is walking in lockstep with the president. So there will be some critiques, but most likely not from the politicians.
All right. John Donnelly, thanks for being with us. John Donnelly's chief diplomatic correspondent for the Boston Globe. Susan Page, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Susan's White House bureau chief for USA Today. Earlier in the program, we talked with Charlie Sennett with the Boston Globe in Sulaymaniyah, northern Iraq, and Scott Peterson with the Christian Science Monitor. He is in Baghdad. We had help with our program today from Kim Bichari, Dara Manoogian, Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. The Connection is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Fields, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugarts. Our interns are Dania Akkad, Andrea Lehman, and Kevin Sangudi. Tara Murphy's our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
Funding for The Connection is made possible by Macromedia, the software company helping to redefine what the web can be. To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.
This is WBUR.